Once again, I do want to welcome you to our second annual Day of Homiletical Reflection, and we are very pleased to have Dr. Haddon Robinson with us today. He is the Harold John Akinyay Distinguished Professor of Preaching at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Dr. Robinson was named one of the 12 most effective preachers in the English-speaking world in the 1996 Baylor University poll. His homiletics textbook, Biblical Preaching, has been used by over 120 seminaries and Bible colleges throughout the world, and he's most famous for his work on expository preaching and has recently begun to integrate the use of narrative preaching into the expository form with your son, Tori, I think is his name, which must bring you some pride as well. Many know Dr. Robinson for his question, "What's the big idea in a text?" which guides the preaching task in understanding the primary intention of a given biblical text for contemporary hearers. He's particularly concerned with presenting the Word of God in an imaginative and attractive and relevant way while remaining faithful to the biblical text. So please welcome him as he speaks on expository preaching in a biblically illiterate culture, Dr. Haddon Robinson.
Two men stood at a bar in downtown Boston, and as people in a bar do, they were enjoying the fellowship of the spirits. And one said to the other, "Where are you from?" Other fellow said, "I'm from Peoria, Illinois." "Peoria, Illinois? I'm from Peoria, Illinois. Did you go to high school there?" "Yeah, I went to high school there." "What high school?" "I went to Central High." "I went to Central High. What years did you go to Central High?" "Well, I'll see, 1978 to 1982. "I went to Central High in Peoria. Same years. Where'd you live in Peoria?" "I lived on North Adams Street." "I lived on North Adams Street. What address?" He said, I lived at 1711 North Adams." "I lived at 1711 North Adams." And just then the phone rang and bartender picked it up and it was his wife. And his wife said, "Well, honey, how's it going?" He said, "Well, it's a slow night. The only people here are the Peterson twins and they're both drunk again." You really don't have to be drunk to feel the spirit in a place like this. You folks know each other and enjoy each other, and just listening to the level of conversation, I know it's, for many of you, like old home week. And I'm delighted to be here. Even though I am not a Lutheran, I have some qualifications. When I grew up, I used to listen to Walter Meyer on the Lutheran Hour. At least my parents did. That's not too big a claim. I also listened to the National Radio Pulpit with Harry Emerson Fosdick and the old-fashioned Revival Hour. Somehow the ecumenical spirit on radio in the 30s was great enough for us to listen. But over the years, I have had interaction with folks in the Missouri Synod, and I have appreciated their concern for a thoughtful understanding of the preaching task. One of the disturbing discoveries that archaeologists have made the last 20-some years has been to discover that the temple of the pagans in the ancient world is very much like the tabernacle and the temple that God had his people erect on Mount Sinai. Pagan temples had an outward court, and then they had an inward court. And then in the center of the inner court was the holiest place they knew. Of course, Israel had an outer court and an inner court, and then at the center of that inner court, there was the holy place, and then within the holy place was the holiest place of all. In the pagan temple, in the center of the holy place, they would have little golden gods or goddesses. The god of war, the goddess of fertility. And at the center of Israel's religion in that sacred place, there was a golden box. And in that golden box were the tablets of the law given to Moses on Mount Sinai. I don't know what you do with that discovery. It certainly seems to say that the difference between the religion of Israel and the religion of the pagans really wasn't centered in their architecture or even in their forms of worship. But the difference between the pagans and the people of Israel was that at the center of Israel's religion was the revealed moral will of God. Taking that to be true, and I do, and the thing that separates men and women who have an allegiance to God and to the call of God is at the center of our preaching, there has to be the revealed moral will of God. That unless we take that will seriously, seek to understand it, seek to apply it, we will have failed in our task. But it is a difficult task. It demands that you be a participant in several different worlds. One of the worlds that you and I must be a part of if we are going to be successful in declaring the revealed moral will of God is the ancient world. It's the world that we enter through exegesis. It's the world of the Bible. We must know that world. And that world has a history. That is, when God chose to reveal himself, he did it to certain people at a certain time, in a certain place, in particular circumstances. And if we are going to accurately interpret God's word and will, we have to have some knowledge of the people to whom that word was spoken. I live up in Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's on the coast. You've seen the film, The Perfect Storm. That's where the storm took place. It was started in 1623. As you might imagine, in the town of Gloucester, we have a number of antique shops. And one of the owners of an antique shop has a kind of wry New England sense of humor. And he has a sign outside. On one side it says, "We buy junk." On the other side, it says, "We sell antiques." Well, if you're into junk or antiques, you'd like Gloucester, Massachusetts. Imagine that you went into one of those stores and you were looking around. And over in the corner, you'd see a trunk. It's old, it's musty, covered with dust, but you're curious. And you open the squeaking lid, you look inside, and there's a kind of velvet covering inside. You feel along that velvet, and then suddenly your thumb hits a lever. Lever opens, and there within that compartment, you find some old letters. They are wrapped in a faded pink ribbon. Well, you sit back there, lid of the trunk, and you look at those letters. As you read those old letters, there's a number of things you could understand. Letters were written by a young man to a young woman, and maybe his girlfriend or his fiancée or perhaps even his wife. It's evident from the letters that he has gone off to some war, and you can sense some of the emotion with which he writes. He is grieving. Some of the comrades with which he went to battle have been killed. He's lonely. He's afraid because the next day they're going into battle. He doesn't know what will happen to him. A lot of things you could understand just reading those letters. But if you really wanted to understand the letters, it would be important to know something about the situation out of which they came. There'd be references in the letter to Bull Run, Harper's Ferry, Chattanooga, maybe even Gettysburg. References to McClellan, to Grant, to Lee, to Jackson. If you did not know the history of our war between the states, there'd be a lot of in that letter, those letters you couldn't get. That is, knowing the history would help you to understand the letters. It's almost impossible to understand the book of Isaiah or the minor prophets unless you know the history out of which they came. To enter that ancient world, you have to know its history. You also need to have an awareness of its language. You are well aware of the fact that the Old Testament was written in Hebrew and the New Testament was written in Greek. I would not argue that in order to understand the Bible, you need to have an understanding of the original languages. It's astonishing how much of the Bible you can learn just by reading it through in English. But there's some help in knowing the original languages. One thing you know is that when you deal with translations, the translator is an interpreter. Translator has to make decisions, and when he makes one decision or they make one decision, that affects the rest of the passage. So in order for you to understand what's going on as you read the translations, it's a help to have a knowledge of what the original language is about, what it was that confused or hung up the translators. You read something like, "The love of Christ constrains me." Some translations take it as an objective genitive, that is, Christ's love constrains me, or subjective genitive, my love for Christ constrains me. If you don't understand what they were dealing with, you're at a bit of a disadvantage. But another reason it's a help to have a knowledge or an awareness of those languages is that language not only communicates thought, it shapes our thought. We think in language. Benjamin Lee Whorf was a noted linguist, spent a good part of his life down in the Southwest working with the Hopi Indians. And he discovered that the Hopi Indians, and rather uneducated people, could understand the theory of relativity when it was explained to them. And the reason is that the Hopis have no time in their language. We can't think apart from time. Now, we think of the past, the present, the future, the past beyond the past, movement in the present, the future beyond the future. We can't think apart from tenses and time. Hopis don't have that. In their language, apparently everything is happening either here where they are or away from them. And as a result of that, because of the way they thought in language, they could understand the theory of relativity. Einstein said he couldn't have thought of the theory of relativity in English. He needed German and mathematics. Well, Whorf went on from there to point out that the Inuits, the Eskimos, do not have a single word for snow in their language. They have 17 words for snow. Words for snow falling, snow hitting the ground, snow beginning to freeze, snow that's frozen, snow that begins to melt. You know, when the Inuits think of snow, they can really think of snow. Just as we do not have a word in English for a bread product made from wheat. If you use the word bread, you think of that stuff at the supermarket wrapped in cellophane, or maybe the long loaf that some Frenchman carries home under his arm. But when we say bread, we don't think of Twinkies, don't think of donuts, don't think of bagels. When we think about bread products made from wheat, we can really think of them. There are cultures in the world that can't do that. They have only one word for the whole thing. So the language you have not only communicates thought, it shapes thought. So when you know something of the language of the Bible, you are entering into the way people thought. Grammar is simply a diagram of the way people think before they speak. It's a help to know the language. It's also a help to know the culture of the ancient world. I hate to admit it, but it was about 25 years ago now that it really dawned on me. The writers of the Bible could not think outside their language, and they really can't think outside their culture. I used to think that the big cultural question was when Paul said, greet one another with a holy kiss, would a hearty handshake do just as well? But you're always running into cultural problems. I do a radio program called Discover the Word. A couple of years ago, we decided that we'd work in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs sounds like a slam dunk. Wisdom literature, everybody has Proverbs. In fact, the whole section of our Proverbs really come out of duplicates of what they had in Egypt. There was a lot of trading of Proverbs. Until you get into it, and then you discover that there have been a number of dissertations written on how the Proverbs are put together. We read them, it seems like buckshot, but there are linguistic, structural clues that say whole sections hang together. For example, the last part of Proverbs, much of what is written there was written to young men who were preparing to be part of the bureaucracy in Solomon's kingdom. And they were telling them how to behave. So when you go to dinner, don't make a hog of yourself. Watch your manners. Don't draw attention to yourself. That's the best way up. Agar has a proverb that says that you can learn something from the ant or the coney or the locust or the lizard. Lizards, they climb a wall. You watch them, they don't seem to move. You look away and they seem to go up. I was in a hotel in Acapulco, Mexico with my wife during our 25th anniversary. 17th story of that hotel. Sitting there reading, looked up and there was a lizard on the wall. How in the world did a lizard get to the 17th story of this hotel? Come up by elevator? How did it know which button to push? There it was. I looked up, nothing happened. I went back to read, and it moved up. It was almost to the ceiling, and I had not seen it move. And the writer of the proverb said, yeah, that's the way you are. Be like a lizard. Don't call attention to yourself, but you'll be in king's palaces. Or the first part of the book of Proverbs. You have these warnings about not co-signing a note. Those wise men were almost ballistic about it. You co-sign a note, beg, plead, get out of it. Well, the reason for that was if you co-signed a note and the first person didn't pay, then it fell to you to pay. And if you couldn't pay, they take you, they take your wife, take your kids, put you into slavery. They wanted their money back. Well, in our day, when we have Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you probably ought to not co-sign a note. You can't pay it. But the consequences today are not that dire. But that's the culture of the ancient world, and you can see why it's a fool's game to sign a note and let it lie out there if they're going to come back at you. All of that is to say that you're constantly faced with cultural problems. Without prejudging the case, you're faced with that in terms of a letter to Timothy and the whole question of women in leadership. I mean, the struggle that exegetes have is there something going on in the culture of Ephesus that caused Paul to write that? Or does that transcend culture? By the way, in raising the question, I'm not answering it. I'm just simply saying you do struggle with cultural questions. So in order to get into the ancient world, you need to have some awareness of the history, the culture, the language. After all, we do want to be faithful expositors of the revealed will of God. But there's a second world that you and I have to enter. The world I think of as homiletics, it's the modern world, a world of the 21st century. And this world, too, has a history. Evangelicals, people take the Bible seriously, have ignored history. But history doesn't ignore us. History keeps knocking on the door. History keeps setting the agenda. And try as we will, we cannot get away from it. I remember the first time I talked with a couple about abortion. It was 1967, and I was working with the Christian Medical Dental Association. I was teaching some Bible studies in the Dallas area for physicians and dentists. And a young medical student at the medical school in Dallas and his wife came to see me. They were in their third year of medical training, and he had a career path out ahead of him. He wanted to specialize in a very minute area of medicine. It meant he was going to have to graduate from med school, then take an internship, and then take two residencies. The next 10 years were pretty well spoken for. And his wife was pregnant. Admittedly, it was the worst possible time for her to have a pregnancy. In those days, a med student couldn't work outside the school. She was raising, getting the income. And so they came to tell me their dilemma, and in the course of it, they said, you think it'd be all right if she had an abortion, given our situation? I can, even as I tell that to you, remember the feeling I had. I mean, if they had said to me, look, we've got a two-year-old, he's driving us nuts when he studies, and when my husband studies him, it'd be all right to kill him. Well, having had a two-year-old, I could understand that. But, I mean, I just was astonished, overwhelmed. At that time, every state in the union had a prohibition against abortion. Next year, Colorado and Hawaii passed laws that allowed an abortion not only if the mother's life was threatened, but if her physical health or psychological health was threatened. Yeah, that began to open up a way to drive a truck through it. But then in 1973, there was Roe versus Wade, and then suddenly abortion became a right of the people, the law of the land. Since that time, every year, at least 1 million preborns are killed. History changed. If statistics mean anything, about 20% of women have had an abortion. You get up on a Sunday morning, you've been to the mountain, and you know what to say, and you're going to thunder about the evil of abortion, and that's why it is the murder of preborns. And unless you've got a skewed congregation, you can almost bet on the fact that there are people in your congregation who have had an abortion. And every time you speak in these ways to talk about it as murder, you rip something open in the inside of a woman who lives with regret. If you don't handle that pastorally as you're preaching, you may do as much harm as you do good. Now, we've ignored history, but history does not ignore us. I wish I could say that the reason that we have integrated churches is that back in the 1940s, theologians got together. Orthodox, biblical-believing theologians got together, read the book of Ephesians. In the book of Ephesians, it says the middle wall of partition is broken down. And, you know, it's Jew and Gentile, but somebody might have said, well, could it also apply to, you know, blacks and whites? Theologians said, yes, it applies, and we must tell our people that the churches have to be integrated. I wish I could say that. That's not how it happened. Rosa Parks got tired of standing in the back of the bus when there were seats in the front, and she sat down and rose up to start a revolution. It wasn't the churches that led the way, though the black churches helped. In fact, took a long time for white churches to even catch on that there was a revolution in the land. You ignore history, history doesn't ignore you. You come into the 21st century and you cannot ignore history. You're facing it, I'm facing it, with the whole issue of homosexuality. It's on the agenda. Just yesterday, before I came, a pastor came by who was in the Methodist church, and he's got a very conservative congregation, but the conversations in the Methodist church are all about this. Reference this morning was a very good one. They want to know where he stands, and he knows it might mean his job. I mean, it's unbelievable that there are major denominations splitting over the issue of homosexual marriages. like it or not, you've got to face it because history sets the agenda. We also have a language in the 21st century. It's the language of the Volkswagen ad, the language of television, the language of radio. It's the language of conversation. If you hear somebody preaching on a Sunday morning, and he has the, you know, another language system going, different inflection. Oh God, thou who sittest on the throne of the universe, we come to thee in your omnipotence and omnipresence and omniscience to ask you for your blessing upon us. You know, and it kind of goes. Imagine after the service, the pastor's going to get something at McDonald's for lunch and drives through the driveway and says to the gal, I would like 2 hamburgers, 2 Cokes, and an order of French fries. She'd think he fell off the turnip truck. I mean, the inflection, the words we use. We are so familiar with the language of Zion that we have lost the language of people in the 21st century. If I taught theology at our seminary, believe me, they wouldn't let me touch it. But if they did, one of the assignments I would have is to take this doctrine and put it in the language of the people in the marketplace. Spurgeon was right when he said the people in the marketplace cannot learn the language of the academy. So people in the academy have to learn the language of the marketplace. And if you expect to reach people in this society, you know, you got to talk their language. There are some whole areas of our preaching culture that confuse preaching with yelling. Catching your breath in the middle of it. The reason for that is that 100 years ago, if you had an audience like this, you had to yell for the people in the back row to get it. And then they invented sound systems. But the tradition has it that yelling is preaching. And people don't come to church to be yelled at. And they don't come to church to be confused. The language system. And it is also a culture that we have to understand. When I think of culture, I think of colored paper. People from the United States have red paper over their eyes. People from Great Britain have blue paper over their eyes. People from Israel have purple paper over their eyes. Every culture has its coloring. Which means that we all sort of look at the same thing, but we don't really see the same thing. In fact, sometimes we don't really see what's there because the color that we have before us blots it out. But when it comes to culture, it is so present that we just assume it. It's only when you go into another culture that you sense something different. And the culture of the 21st century presents problems to you. For example, how do you preach the lordship of Christ in a republic or a democracy? I mean, every 2 years, the people in Congress come by, want our vote. Every 4 years, presidents come by, they want our vote. Every 6 years, senators come by, they want our vote. Now, we can vote them in, and the theory is we can vote them out. How do you preach the lordship of Christ in a culture like that? I mean, there are a lot of people who think that the doctrine of election is that God says yes, the devil says no, and we cast the deciding vote. Read the New Testament, and you discover God is not running for election, not for office. He is not the president or the senator of the world. I mean, Peter stated it bluntly. God has made him Lord in Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. It's like the law of gravity. You can defy it, but if you do, you're destroyed. The blunt teaching of the Bible is God is a sovereign, an absolute despot, and you either bow the knee to him or you'll go to hell. It's even hard for me to say that because I know a culture like this finds that difficult to hear. But how do you preach the lordship of Christ? One thing you don't do is to say to people, make Jesus Christ Lord of your life. Ah, you can use the words, I guess. But that, you really are not in that position of putting him in. Or how do you preach grace in a culture like ours? I read Advertising Age from time to time. Not worth subscribing to, but worth going to a library to take a look at it. If you look at Advertising Age, they describe campaigns that the companies have. USA Today does that to a small degree on Mondays. It shows you the idea they're trying to get across. Then they tell you about the media buys, and then they tell you about why they bought the media, and then what the results of this campaign are. And one of the things advertisers found out is that Americans who want to indulge in unrestrained materialism need to be convinced that they have a right to this. And so you get these ads, the Buick ad. It's later in the evening, and there's a beautiful new Buick, fortunately under a street light so you can see it. And then there's a building, and at the top of the building there's a light, and then the light flips off, and the narrator, the over voice says, you've made it to the top. You worked hard. Now you can get your prize. Guy walks out of the building, gets in his car, drives off. So driving a Buick isn't a way to get from point A to point B. It's a way of leaving your neighbors in your exhaust fume. But you deserve it. You've earned it. You know, for a while, the national anthem was, you deserve a break today. Think about that. If everything from Buicks to hamburgers is something you deserve, then how do you preach grace to people in our culture? You better be aware of the cultural influences, way people hear you. If you're going to reach them, break down their defenses to speak to them the word of God. Now, to be effective, you have to be able to speak to the 21st century. Bainton, in his introduction to his biography of Martin Luther, says, every man that has ever influenced his age for God has first of all been caught up in the spirit of that age and then is able to speak a word of judgment and of grace. There's a third world we have to enter, not only the world of the Bible, the world of the modern world, but the particular world. That's the world that you serve in. It's the church at 5th and Main, the congregation with a zip code. That world, too, has to be understood. Every thoughtful pastor is aware of the winds that cross the culture. But you're also aware of what goes on in your church. Every church has a history. You come in, you know, they assign you there, and you got this new assignment. You come in fresh and vital. The congregation didn't come in new, fresh, and vital. They have a history. Some of them have a history that's 100 years old. They don't even know it, but boy, that's their way of doing it. You want to change things. You've been convinced that we've got to get out and do evangelism, go door to door. They greet it with a kind of wide yawn. Or maybe we can do something with the junior department. Well, and it goes, you know. We can do something with the young people. We've got to change the music a bit. You suddenly discover there's a history here. When I was teaching at Dallas, one of our students did a final paper. He had a church in East Texas. He'd just come. It was 1972, 73. He decided he wanted to do a history of his church, and well, we thought that'd be all right. So he did. They found out that congregation back in the 50s had had, there was a young black man who had been accused of raping a white woman. Vigilante group got hold of him and took him and on the lawn of that church erected a cross and burned him to death. In the early 60s, the church had split. In a big city, if you don't like the church you're in, there's another Lutheran church someplace you can go to, or maybe another denomination. Small town, though, you can't change churches. Splits in a small town. The church splits, family splits, business splits. I mean, it affects the whole community. This church, it had done great damage. When this young man came, the pulpit committee, the leadership of the church, never told him anything about all this until he got there and discovered when he'd go out to invite people to the church, people in that church knew the history. And found themselves up against the back wall that he'd never even realized. You have a history. They have a history. And they have a language. Some of you serve in, you know, rural areas, in Nebraska, Iowa. I admire you. You know the language. I grew up in the ghetto of New York. When I was in Denver, I used to get up at 5 every morning to flip on the radio when I was shaving, and they had the stock reports. Beef was 73 cents. Never did find out what that meant. Is that a whole cow? Half a cow? What's 73 cents? I mean, tell you this, if you live in Aurora, Nebraska, you know what that means. Where are the weather? That's the language you speak. When you come from the outside, boy, it takes you a while to learn that language. We had a man come to Denver Seminary when I was the president there. He'd come from England, and on the way he had gone to Chicago, and he'd come to Denver. He'd not been in the United States before. And he was trying to illustrate, and you got to give him 21 points for trying that. And he said when he was in Chicago, he went to see a baseball contest. It was between the New York team and the Chicago White Stockings. And he described that game in terms that were just barely distinguishable. And he said in the last at-bats, the Chicago club got up, and they got men on the different stations. And then a batter got up and got a four-base hit, and White Stockings won the game. Well, there's no such thing as a four-base hit. Two bases, three bases, you know, no such thing. We knew he was talking about a home run. And, you know, we didn't sit there and writhe, but we knew he wasn't one of us. He didn't have the language. Little thing. Boy, to serve in those areas, you better learn that language. Or every time you speak, you sound like an outsider. And your church and your area has a culture. That may be the most difficult thing for you to understand when you go to a church. Social scientists say it takes about 5 years to really understand the culture of a place. In the United States, pastors change pulpits every 2.5 to 3 years. So they never understand. But the farm community has a culture. It used to bother me to think of, if God called me to the place that some of you guys serve in, small towns, small communities, I'd die. I love cities. I go to New York, it turns me on. Guy from a small town turns them off. I just know I don't know that culture. It used to bother me. I used to think, you know, am I resisting God? I knew it would take two angels writing it on the wall and dragging me to go out to Nebraska. No, the truth is that culture is so distinctly different from mine that I know I wouldn't fit it. Some of you in your growing up have been fashioned for certain kinds of churches. There's nothing wrong with that. It's great stuff. But you better know it to preach effectively. But there's one other world that we have to enter. Not only the ancient world, the Bible, the modern world of homiletics, particular world, but it's the world represented by these little figures here. You hardly notice it, but it's your world. You bring something to the ministry. Like you bring a lot to the ministry. You have a history. It's amazing, isn't it, how we all bring our childhood into our adulthood. But how you grew up has a way of affecting you. Often been pointed out that people who become ministers or lawyers or physicians are often only child or first children in a family. Not all by any means, but you know, it tends that way. The argument is that you grow up as a first child and you know your parents really lay it on you, want you to succeed. Some of you know that. You've grown up in homes in which your parents are sort of perfectionistic. You get 3 A's and a B, and they'd say, how come you didn't get 4 A's? So you'd work hard, get 4 A's, and they say, there's something wrong with the school system. You get A's that easily. I mean, you never please them. And one of the marks of people like that is they become angry. They have a kind of level of anger inside of them. And you bring that into ministry. You have a history, and you don't come in clean of that. It affects the way you minister. You have a language. When something goes wrong in your life, you talk to yourself real fast. Often so fast you don't even hear it, but if you slow it down, you realize you have instinctive reactions to the way things happen to you. And you have a culture out of which you've come. I come out of the ghetto of New York. I grew up in an area of Harlem called Mousetown. Reader's Digest called it the toughest section in the United States. It's a history. It had a language. Can't use it a lot in the pulpit, but they had a language. And they had a culture. And I bring that. I mean, one question is, what does the text do to you? But another question is, what do you do to the text? And I'm aware of the fact that I often come to the text shaped by my background, and I have to work to get rid of it. There are two great doctrines that hold me. I suspect there are doctrines that hold you. I wish I could say they came out of deep study of theology. I really think they were shaped by my background. In fact, I think you can give a test to people, a psychological test, and I could pick out the people who are, just say, strong Calvinists. You know, not just hold the 5 points, but sovereign grace, anytime you get with them. You could talk to people on the other end of the spectrum, people we often call Arminians. Live with God for 30 years and make one mistake and you're lost forever. I think I could pick them out psychologically. I think out of the infinitude that's God, we make our choices as to what we emphasize. For me, one great doctrine that holds me is the doctrine of depravity. Growing up in New York, I just believe everybody's depraved. Best proved doctrine of the Christian faith. I mean, everybody's got a curvature of the soul. Everybody's got poison blood in their veins. When I talk to people, we have a lot of them back in Massachusetts, more liberal, who tell me that people are essentially good. You know, there's some blips of bad, but they're essentially good. I can't even talk to them. I don't even know how to begin. They haven't read their newspaper. It's like, I was out in Iowa one time, and I talked to a man at a restaurant who believed the earth was flat, having lunch in the middle of the conversation. He said, well, you know, one of the things that's happening at our university, they don't teach people the world is flat anymore. I said, wait a minute. You mean, I don't know what you mean. It's round. Oh, no, it's flat. And he quoted some verses from Ecclesiastes, I think. I said, we've sent people up in the universe, just, you know. I said, no, it's like a plate. They go around. What? How do you teach a guy or argue with a guy out in the middle of Iowa at a restaurant and prove to him that the earth is round? you sort of give up. And, you know, he convinced me the world is flat. But I believe in depravity. I believe we all suffer from it. The second doctrine that holds me is the grace of God. I believe in the depths of my soul, God's grace. I have a friend who several years ago was going through a deep depression. He and his wife had a second home out in East Texas. And in Tyler, Texas, they call it the rose capital of the world. And he said one Sunday afternoon, he was sitting on the back porch looking out, and his wife grew roses. The day before, she had had a farmer in the area dump a load of manure on her rose garden. And he sat there looking at the roses, and he could smell the manure. And he said, suddenly it dawned on him that God grows roses out of manure piles. Not exactly the deepest statement of the doctrine, you know, but he's right. God's always growing roses out of manure piles. If you can't handle the manure, get out of the ministry. You'll be into it up to your kneecaps. But if you look for the roses, God's working in people's lives, it's amazing what you can see. Those two doctrines hold me. They are not the only doctrines of the Christian faith. I need other people to remind me of that. It comes out of my background, out of my history, out of my culture. You bring something to that ministry. If you're an angry person, then you can turn almost any text into guilt. You know, you just do it. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has begotten us to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that fades on away, reserved in heaven for you, brimming with hope. Preacher gets all of a sudden, you don't have that hope, do you? You don't have it as strongly as you should. You know, every day you go to, every week you go to church, they keep raising the bar on you. That's not what that text says. That's the way we read it. We bring to the text something of ourselves. Well, all of that is to say, if we're going to take the moral will of God, the scriptures, and bring them to bear to people in the 21st century, not enough just to know the text. We have to know the culture. Have to know the people to whom we minister to within that culture. And someplace or other, before you get into that very far, you better know yourself. Because when you stand to preach, people don't hear a sermon. They hear you. And what you are has a lot to do with the text you choose, the way you develop them, and the tone of what you say. It's an enormous task. Sometimes you want to throw up your hand and say, well, who's sufficient for this? The answer is none of us. Unless God does a work in us and through us and for us, we don't have a ghost of a chance. But of course, that's the good news. This is His work. And if we're open to Him, we can see the culture that we live in with different eyes.
Thank you, Dr. Robinson.